This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You're listening to the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
Broadcasting from the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Ho-Ho-Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanhounds.
Comic book fans, welcome. Welcome back once more to the illustrious, hard-traveling fanboys. Emphasis on fanboys. We are coming to you live via tape delay from Ho-Ho-Loon Plaza, the L-shaped studio, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I am Greg Phillips. With me, unfortunately, as always, is the bitter and vitriolic Nick Duke.
Bitter and vitriolic. And listen to me, even though last week you were delving into my territory. You, sir, were taking a little walk on the dark side with me, but now you're going to aspersions on me for being bitter and vitriolic, even though last week, Greg, you embraced the hate and you liked it.
No, I was taking a walk with you to Club Dark Side.
No, that's a different podcast.
Well, sort of the same, because, you know, you wouldn't have a Dr. Simon Hurt if you didn't have a Boss Darkseid, right?
Or a Mr. Lebasu.
You sure wouldn't, Tony. Or a Pierrot Lunaire.
Why are they all French?
I have no idea why they're all French. They sure as hell are. Mm-hmm. So, we are bringing you something this week. It's a bit of a palate cleanser, ladies and gentlemen. We needed something to bring the positivity and the joy back to the hard-traveling studios. You know, we were in a negative place last week. There's no getting around it. We were bitter. We were angry. We were confused, sexually, emotionally, and otherwise. And we wanted to come back this week and remind ourselves and indeed our listeners what is great about the comic book industry, and what is great about, in particular, the character of the Dark Knight, Batman himself. Because while last week we reviewed a story here that we agreed was one of the worst Batman stories that we'd read, we wanted to counter this week by counting down our five favorite Batman stories of all time. As we always say with Countdown, this is a subjective thing. There's no sort of set criteria. We're not grading these based on critical reception. We're not grading these based on sales.
The only thing objective about Countdown is that my lists are always objectively better than yours.
And the other objective thing is that Countdown is always recorded on opposite day. Mm. So everything Nick just said is true because today's opposite day. My list, on the other hand,
what the fuck are you babbling about?
Is put together with honesty and integrity, which, being that it's opposite day, means that I cheated. Which that in and of itself would mean that I was telling the truth and doing it honestly, which would mean that it was also a lie. So you create opposite day is something I've never understood since I was a kid, because it just opens too many philosophical questions, Nick.
What are you talking about, opposite day? What is this?
You never had opposite day when you were a kid?
No.
My God, what kind of childhood did you have? You go to school.
A good
and
one?
You say,
that's not true, actually.
And you say to your friend, you say, I am the smartest, I am the best. And your friend says, no, today's opposite day. That means you're the dumbest and the worst. And then you say, hey, I...
And then you say, me am Bizarro?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. What? And put coffee in cup? What you think me am, stupid? This begs the question, Nick. What are we counting down exactly? As I mentioned, it's our five favorite Batman stories. And
yes, that begs the question that you've already answered.
That I already answered. Nothing begs that question. It begs an answer to it.
No one is begging for the answer to any questions from us. You know, thanks to our six listeners out there.
And we do appreciate all six of you.
Yes.
And hope that you're all having rich, fulfilled lives. Although we also wish that they're not as good as our lives, which are not very good. So.
Unless you like Batman R.I.P., in which case we wish you nothing positive in life. We hope all the bad things in life happen to you and only to you.
Nick was actually voted Player Hater of the Year 2004.
Hate.
We're doing a countdown. It's pretty straightforward. And we're not judging these also based on sales or anything like that. These are the stories that we think of when we want to go to our happy place with Batman, who obviously is the most popular character in comics worldwide. I think that's been proven by this point. Known the globe over. The biggest star for DC Comics. And Nick's favorite fictional character, as he oft went around and reminded people back in college. That's still the case, Nick?
Yeah, absolutely. Batman is the greatest character in this business, in this industry, in this genre. And as a result, I've had a lifelong affinity. And this could be a fun podcast to talk about our top five Batman stories of all time with no artificial limitations put on my list the way certain individuals were hinting they might do for their list.
I ended up not doing that.
Oh.
Now, would it be fair to say then, Nick, that Batman is the Bret Hart of comic books?
No.
I think it is, from the way you've laid it out.
No, I think Batman would be the Hulk Hogan of comic books, and the Bret Hart of comic books would be let's see.
No.
The Bret Hart of comic books would be...
So Batman's a racist?
Like the Martian Manhunter. You know, like, he's a nice little hand. You know, he's decent, plays his role well, but never a real, you know, top draw in the industry.
You know, I never took Batman to be the kind that would, you know, have to pay millions in alimony and be a racist guy. But that's just me.
Well, Batman can also still walk and do things, so there's that as well.
Well, that's true. He hasn't suffered a stroke. But Batman still has his hair, so he can't be the Shawn Michaels of the comic book industry either.
No, he can't.
It's really interesting. Anyway, let's get this show.
Batman is the Ho-Ho-Loon of the comic
book
industry.
There we go. Nice. Underappreciated, undervalued, but no less great.
Yes, exactly.
Well, let's get our list started. Do you want to start or should I?
It's up to you. You make the call, sir.
I'll kick it off. And, you know, on our list of the top five Batman stories, much of our lists, I'm assuming, will be centered on the greatness of Batman, certainly, but also they will be focused on his alter ego, Bruce Wayne, billionaire industrialist who is tortured inside and uses that to fuel his mission as the Caped Crusader in Gotham. Well, my number five book has none of that. Because my number five Batman story of all time is a little story by Scott Snyder and Jock with a helping hand from Francesco Francavilla, and it is called Batman the Black Mirror. This book came out in 2000 and I want to say 9 is when it started anyway. It ran through 2010, I know. But it started in 2009. And no, it didn't, actually. I take that back. Says here that it started January 2011. Disregard everything I just said and everything I've ever believed. So, the black market, the place where you go to buy children's...
We are off to a rip-roaring start already.
I'm really tired. There's no getting around it. But, The Black Mirror is a story that takes place when Bruce Wayne is believed to have been... After Bruce Wayne is believed to have been killed, actually, because it takes place while Bruce Wayne is in Batman Incorporated. That's right, Batman Incorporated.
Oh, yeah, Bruce actually – I always forget that – for some reason, I always just assume that they thought he was dead at this point, you know, even though he had come back. You're right, yeah. So, yeah, Bruce is actually off around the world doing other things, and Dick Grayson had continued on as the Batman of Gotham City.
That's right. When Dick took over when Bruce was believed to be killed, and then when Bruce came back, Bruce decided he still wanted Batman to be Dick Grayson to be Batman, and he would be Batman traveling the world, establishing Batman in other countries. And that's another story for another time. But the point remains, Dick Grayson is still Batman in Gotham City. He's still got a Robin and Damian Wayne. And he's got to figure out a way to hold this city together and to hold this role of Batman together. Because a weird thing has happened in the last, year that he's been, or 6 months or so that he's been Batman. He's actually grown into the role and kind of made it his own over the course of the issues of Batman and Robin and books like that. He's kind of started to become a little, if you can ever be comfortable as Batman, besides being Bruce, he's started to kind of carve that role out. But this offers him his greatest challenge yet, and this also offers him, in many ways, an indication of what Bruce has to go through to keep his role going as Batman, because Dick is faced with a lot of challenges in this. He's faced with a secret organization, as Batman often is. He's faced with the city itself almost feeling like it is this entity unto itself. And that's what this story did, in addition to having the best Dick Grayson that I've ever read in a comic. This story also has the best Gotham City, I think, that I've read outside of some of the books that we're going to get to later. Because this is a book that really feels like Gotham is a character unto itself in a way that I don't know that I had fully read before this. Gotham is a living, breathing entity. It's even referenced at points during this book as Dick is having his conversations with Jim Gordon that this city almost feels like it's swallowing him up. Like there's this black hole of negativity and hatred and corruption that you can never destroy, because no matter how much you fight it, it's going to consume you eventually. And Dick is really pushed to his limits in this story. He gets a love interest here briefly. He has to deal with the return of James Gordon Jr. to town, who is Jim Gordon's son. Yeah, and as we find out here,
and we say return very loosely, because
right,
yes, technically we had been introduced to this character a long time ago, back in the pages of year one, but nobody had really touched on and done anything with him in the almost 30 years
yeah,
that you know, were in between those two stories. So this was, you know, it was Scott Snyder kind of pulling a Jeff Johns, where he dusts off this obscure character and kind of, you know, completely reinvents him and makes him a, I would argue, what needs to be a more regular addition to the Batman mythos going mm-hmm. forward.
No question. He was a baby, actually, the last time anybody saw him in the pages of year one, and I think he's referenced in Long Halloween and Dark Victory, but no one had touched him since then. And it's a character that comes back changed as a grown man mm-hmm. and provides a creepy, sinister foil to both Dick Grayson's Batman and Barbara Gordon's Oracle, and really is the linchpin villain of this. A lot of that is drawn by Francesco Francavilla, who does an amazing job on it, at creating this sense of horror and dread around every corner. You also get in Black Mirror more of an exploration of Jim Gordon than I think we've gotten in Batman comics in recent years, with the exception of a story that Scott Snyder returned to later on during his run. But it was almost a perfect storm of events for me. It's a Dick Grayson story with him as Batman, as the guy, an A-list character. He's not anybody's sidekick. He's not getting beaten up to set up a villain for Bruce Wayne or anybody else. He's here as his own man, as Batman, coming into his own as the Dark Knight, but also still doing it his own way. He's still got Dick Grayson's sense of humor. He's still got Dick Grayson's sense of optimism. But ultimately, this is a story about Dick Grayson's optimism versus the relentless cynicism of Gotham City. How long can he maintain who he is and what he is when he's being attacked on every level of his being by this city that has turned Bruce into what he is? And I think it's a masterpiece. I've said that many times. I believe that to this day, this is Scott Snyder's masterpiece. As great as all of his other stuff on Batman was, as great as his Bruce Wayne was, I think his Dick Grayson was even better. And this Black Mirror is my favorite Dick Grayson story of all time, and as I mentioned here, my fifth favorite Batman story of all time, on the basis of doing something different. it's a story that we had not seen before and may not ever see again because of the specifics that went into it. I think it's brilliant. I think it's still my favorite Scott Snyder story. And hopefully, I still, one of my pipe dreams in comics is for him to write Nightwing, because damn it, he just gets it. So anyway, Scott Snyder's The Black Mirror, with amazing art from Jock and Francesco Francavilla, comes in at 5 for me.
The shocking thing here is that I have to withhold comment for now. I would have thought this would be much higher on your list than it actually
is.
Wow. So I'm surprised by this.
I thought you would accuse me of recency bias if I included it higher on my list.
Well, I'm looking at my list right now. Well, I mean, you know, I have a little recency bias. I'll admit that. And speaking of recency bias, we'll just go ahead and move right along to my number 5. From one Scott Snyder pinned entry to another. And I'm going to – you may call this something of a cop-out, Greg, but I've made this argument many times that I count this as one story and always will. And I am speaking, of course, of Scott Snyder's 11-issue story that opened his Batman New 52 run, that, of course, being Court of Owls and Night of the Owls. Collected separately, but to me it's one big story, so, you know, have what you will. Last week we talked about how stupid it was that Grant Morrison tried to imply that the character of Dr. Simon Hurt had always been there, operating in the background of Batman stories, always pulling strings and the things of that sort. And it was.
Nothing if not hypocrites.
And it was stupid, because the story sucked, Simon Hurt sucks, and Grant Morrison sucks. So here is Scott Snyder taking that approach and doing it better. Doing it right, one might say, by revealing the mysterious Court of Owls, a conspiratorial organization that has made up of Gotham's wealthy and elite that have controlled Gotham for centuries. They use their political and economic influence to bully and intimidate and outright murder people to subtly influence Gotham, the events in Gotham City's history. We get here in the opening pages of New 52, Batman talking about, you know, a Gotham that he doesn't really understand right now, you know, carrying on that theme that you mentioned from Black Mirror, where Gotham is kind of evolving into something that first Dick and now Bruce is not really sure what to make of. And ultimately, it's revealed that this is because the Court of Owls are exerting their influence even more heavily than they have in years past. Throughout this story, we get to see how the Wayne family tree is tied into all of this, including a big reveal at the end, or an implication at the end, that to this day we're not really sure what to make of it. We don't know if it's true or not. We don't know if the character of Lincoln March is telling the truth about his origin or not, and I would argue that's a good thing, to leave it ambiguous like that, because it would be such a status quo, a seismic status quo shift for the Waynes as we know them, to explicitly confirm that what Lincoln March says is the truth. I'm debating whether or not we're worried about spoilers for 7-year-old books or not, and I'm erring on the side of we're not. So, yes, Lincoln March at the end of the story reveals that, or implies, that he is Bruce's long-lost brother who was given up by the Waynes and placed into an institution and has come back years later to take revenge on Bruce. Throughout the story, though, we also get other Bat family members who are implied to have a shared past with the Court of Owls they were previously unaware with, including Dick Grayson, who is implied to have been a Talon, or been tagged or tapped to be a Talon for the Night of for the Court of Owls at some point. But in addition to this awesome labyrinthine dark story that we get with Gotham, with the mysterious backstory of Gotham City, we also get some outstanding visuals. Greg Capullo is at the peak of his powers here. We've talked about on this podcast numerous times before whether it was, you know, just praising Capullo in general, or talking specifically about our favorite Snyder and Capullo issues from the New 52 run, what I call the labyrinth issue, where he is, Batman is trapped beneath the streets of Gotham City. The Court of Owls has him in this giant maze, and he's been in there for days, and he's essentially losing his mind. He's going crazy from sleep deprivation and exhaustion. His eye is bulging out of his cowl and bloodshot red. The pages themselves are turning around. to enhance that feeling of being lost. And just the entire thing reaches, it's a rare example of a story that reached across the Bat universe and actually felt like it warranted it. So many times throughout the New 52, and even to this day, other Bat titles get pulled in and it feels kind of arbitrary, but this was one, Night of Owls specifically, where you understood that every hero who was based in Gotham was affected by this. It's very rare to see writers, especially in the modern context, be able to add something lasting to the Batman mythos, and I would argue the Court of Owls is one of those examples. Already, just an outstanding addition, something that I look forward to seeing other writers take on in the decades to come. So, for me...
And still, yes. The last example that we have seen of a lasting original Batman villain, right? I can't think of any since then.
Yeah, I can't either.
It's such a great concept. The Court of Owls concept is so good and so well executed. They're gonna be around in perpetuity in Batman comics. They're gonna outlast a lot of the more modern villains because it's a great concept that you can continue to go back to. You can tell retro Batman stories about the Court of. We saw it, Nick, in one of the volumes of All Star Western that we reviewed, where they used the Court of Owls in like 1800s Gotham.
Yeah.
So that just the concept of the Court of Owls alone, when you pair it with how well Snyder writes Batman and his family, it just doesn't get – comics don't get a lot better than this.
Absolutely.
Anything else to say about your entry, sir?
No, I'm good.
Very well. Well, I will move on to my number four, which is more of a, admittedly, legacy pick here, more of a historical pick, but also a book that I would argue holds up extremely well. Mm-hmm. This is a book that changed the face of comic books, changed the mm-hmm. face of Batman mm-hmm. for decades to come, indelibly. And this is a book by Frank Miller mm-hmm. called The Dark Knight Returns.
That's my painting!
You're number four as well?
Yes.
Outstanding. Well, it is, at this point, Dark Knight Returns is one of those books like Watchmen that I think many, many people much, much smarter than we have opined about, have praised. I also want to give some love to inker Klaus Janson on this mm-hmm. as well. He was outstanding. And the colorist Lynn Varley, who was Frank Miller's main squeeze at the time. So I'm not going to take you through the plot of The Dark Knight Returns. Everybody knows this. If you haven't read The Dark Knight Returns, read it. It went through a period where it was the most revered comic book of all time at one point. It went through a period where people said it was overrated and to some degree still are saying, making that argument. And I think in recent years it's kind of rejuvenated itself again as we've seen a lot of the stuff that Frank Miller prophesied in this book come true. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff that Frank Miller was commenting on about society then and where he saw the sort of yuppie society of the mid-80s going is kind of where we've ended up today. The political allegories are there. The cable news allegories in particular, the way that we consume media is so similar to what Frank Miller was writing about and drawing about in 1984, 85, that it's uncanny at times, Nick. I know I went through and reread this book, I think last year, or maybe it was 2017. It was 2017, I went back and read this book again, and I was floored by how good it is, by how well it holds up, and by how much it mirrors what's happened in society. And that's just the subtext of the book. When you look at the basic Batman of it all, what Frank Miller did was take the basic concept of what Denny O'Neil was trying to do in the late 60s and early 70s mm-hmm. and take it to its natural conclusion, mm-hmm. which was getting Batman back to being the Dark Knight again.
It's number four on my list. It's not number one, but I think if you were making a list of the five most influential Batman stories of all time, this is mm-hmm. a slam dunk number one.
Absolutely,
and
no question.
And a slam dunk number two is the other Frank Miller story, Year One, because virtually every take on Batman that has come since Year One and Dark Knight Returns is either trying to work forward from the premise of Year One or work toward the premise of Dark Knight Returns. Virtually That's every right. interpretation is trying to become one of these two incarnations of Batman. This has been used, Dark Knight Returns, that is, has been used as inspiration for so many different adaptations of the character, whether it be the big screen adaptation in both The Dark Knight Rises and in the most recent Ben Affleck take. It was also responsible, as you said, for kind of causing Batman 89 to be a little bit different of a movie than it probably would have been prior to the release of Dark Knight Returns. It proved that there was an audience for a bit more mature take, permanently allowing DC to move away fully from the camp-inspired era of the 1960s with the Batman 66 television show. And it's also served as the inspiration for one of DC's finest animated movies, direct-to-DVD animated movies, the two-part adaptation of this story. So, all great stuff. All the way around. Like you said, the plot, everybody knows the plot at this point. We could comment so much about how it, you know, kind of changed the face of comics, but realistically, there is the DC universe before this, and there is the DC universe after right. this, not from a narrative standpoint, but from a publishing standpoint, from an editorial standpoint. To me, this and Watchmen are the two most influential DC comic books
yes.
of all time.
Absolutely. This popularized, by the way, the internal monologue box, mm-hmm. which has become, frankly, the foundation of modern comics that we know anyway. The books, most of the books that I can think of that I've loved since I got back into comics in the early 2000s run with that approach of the main character's inner monologue, noir style, in little caption boxes. Dark Knight Returns did that with Batman, and so many writers since then have tried to capture that voice for Batman, right? That monologue of him talking about feeling the pavement beneath his feet, feeling the Gotham skyline.
Or even tried to fit that voice onto other characters. I mean,
right.
You know, it's done through every lens imaginable now. And like you said, it had been done rarely to this point, but this is undoubtedly the sea change. This is what popularized it and made it one of the biggest comic book tropes out there now.
Not that there had not been different takes on these characters before, mm-hmm. but he also popularized and made it okay to do something wildly different with the Joker, mm-hmm. to do something wildly different with Catwoman than what had come before, to do something wildly different with characters that we were so familiar with over the course of, at that point, what had been, you know, what, 50 years mm-hmm. of Batman at that point, almost, and he managed to. He gave us, of course, that David Bowie inspired Joker that led to things like Heath Ledger's different Joker, that led to things like Grant Morrison's different Joker, Scott Snyder's different Joker. Every Joker incarnation that we've seen since then kind of owes itself to this spirit of creativity that came out of this. And there's really, for all the stuff that's been, and even Frank Miller himself has sort of plagiarized his voice on these characters in this over the time. But for all the stuff that gets said about Miller in his later years, during this phase, he might be the GOAT. If you take Frank Miller during this phase of his creativity, who else in comics, maybe a small handful of people in the history of comics, have ever been that creative, have ever been that good at just capturing the cultural zeitgeist, at capturing the spirit of the moment, and also being able to express that both in words and in his art, which it's not traditionally what I would consider great art, but it's perfect for this story. And yeah, this book will stand the test of time, and it already has. And if you haven't read Dark Knight Returns, read it, because it is not it's not just a good book for the 1980s. It's a good book today, especially if you can remove yourself from the cliches and remove yourself from things that may feel like cliches now, but certainly weren't back then.
Also, one of, if not the most iconic covers of all time, with the image of Batman in shadow leaping against the drop of the backdrop of the lightning bolt. Just mm-hmm. one of the most iconic images in all of Batman lore. So, yeah, my number four as well.
Well, let's stick with Frank Miller, folks, because I'm moving on to my number three that was very nearly my number one. It is a book that I voted at number one as the greatest origin story in the history of comics, and it is Batman Year One by Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli. Now, Nick kind of hinted at this, that every Batman story since has either been working from Year One or working toward The Dark Knight. And in this case, the reason for that is that this builds perhaps the greatest foundation upon which you could possibly build a character. I've often told Nick this before off the air. I think I've probably said on the show that I think Batman is the most automatic character in comics. It is actively difficult to write a bad Batman story. You can write an average Batman story, but you have to really do something nutty like Zur-En-Arr to write a bad Batman story.
Or try to stretch a story out for 110 issues, in the opinion of Greg Phillips, anyway.
That's right. Well, a boring story that goes nowhere. Mm-hmm. But you can tell a good story over however many issues you want. But this story, which included colors by Richmond Lewis, not Richmond Vernon, but Richmond Lewis. That's just for you, Nick.
Oh, God. I say there. Richmond Vernon.
He was your employee, my friend.
He was. Not really an employee. That would imply that there was money being exchanged.
There were services being exchanged.
Hey, now. Richmond Vernon's very conservative. We don't need implications out there about Mr. Vernon.
What about Vernon T. Waldron?
What about the old WTVY weatherman Vernon?
Connor Vernon.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Oh. What about Ernest's neighbor, Vern?
Vern? That's good. What about Vern Lundquist?
I think we end it. Oh, wow!
There we go.
Right there. So, yeah, Batman Year One. The best origin story ever, in my opinion, in comics. It stripped the Batman mythos down to its bare core, which had been gotten away from over the years. Because ultimately, What it started as is this guy who goes out on a mission of vengeance to kick criminals' asses. And this kind of strips away all – it strips Robin out of it. It strips the humor out of it, quite frankly. It strips all of the excess bells and whistles, and it makes it into a pulpy crime story first and foremost. Organized crime, corrupt police force, wronged person on a mission for vengeance. Boy, it sounds a lot like a Liam Neeson movie, doesn't it, Nick?
Yes.
And this version of Bruce Wayne that Frank gives us is still, to this day, my favorite version of Bruce. This is the tortured, hateful, trying to find a way to deal with his pain, Bruce Wayne. And we get the story of that, that Batman is not an immediate success, that Batman has struggles. And really, Bruce has to figure out why he has to be Batman. There's that iconic scene that every Batman writer since then has done, including Grant Morrison, including Snyder, including Jeff Loeb. Everybody that's written Batman since then has done their version on I Must Become a Bat. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That scene. So good. So great. So amazing. It's maybe the most memorable Batman scene, in my opinion. It might be the most iconic Batman scene because it tells you everything. It's Bruce and he's staring at this window and there's all this moodiness and shadow. And all of a sudden the bat comes crashing through the window. And yes, we've seen that before, but this version of that is the one that I think most people think of. This story in general, it just works. And one of the reasons that it works, and one of the reasons that I actually have it ranked ahead of Dark Knight Returns, is I prefer the David Mazzucchelli art. It is so good. And he draws one of the Batmen that stands out most in my mind. It's unique. It's distinctly his, but it owes so much to the original, you know, Bob Kane art from the early days, and yet he does his own thing with it, and it's so smooth and almost feels like you're. It feels a little bit Darwin Cookie even. Mm-hmm. And when you pair that with Frank Miller's, for lack of a better term, film noir detective, his Maltese Falcon approach to Batman, it just creates something that we've seen imitated so many times since, but never duplicated. It is a masterpiece of the comic book medium. It holds up today just as well as it did back then. It's one of those books, one of those small number of comic books that I would hand anybody that's never read a comic book and say, read this, and if you don't like it, maybe they're not for you. I think it's a book that will hold up forever, as I mentioned with Dark Knight Returns, because it is the ultimate example of who this character is and why this character is. And it doesn't have any bullshit about Zurin R. It doesn't have any kind of labyrinthine continuity that you have to know. You can read this book and not have any idea who any of these characters are going in, and it works. It's tremendous.
All fantastic points. I must admit that this was the final cut from my list, so it didn't actually make my top five, which is blasphemous in a lot of circles, I know. But I love the story.
Almost as blasphemous as Michael Lolo with candy.
Slava Medvedenko. In any event, outstanding choice from you, sir. Like I said, just missed my list. At my number three, I have a story that Greg has already talked about. I can't believe I had this higher than Greg. Somehow, my third favorite Batman story of all time, accuse me of recency bias if you like, is not even a Bruce Wayne as Batman story. It's a Dick Grayson as Batman story, because part of the appeal of Batman is not just the character himself, it is the world around him. And as Greg said so perfectly, there you could make an argument that never in any story, outside of perhaps the later Quarter of Owls and Night of Owls, has Gotham City felt more alive and like a character unto itself than in The Black Mirror from Scott Snyder, Jock, and Francesco Francavilla. Outstanding stuff. Bringing back James Gordon, James Gordon Jr., redefining that character, providing a new angle from which to view, you know, Jim Gordon Sr. as a man who is not a perfect dad by any stretch of the imagination, but has really faced impossible circumstances throughout his life. Once you combine what has happened to his daughter with this son that he has no idea what to make of, how to deal with, or how to help reintegrate into society, really. Arguably, I would say that, and you know more about Nightwing history than I do, Greg, but I would argue that Dick Grayson as a solo character has never really had one iconic villain, one arch nemesis. I know Blockbuster is something that people will throw out there a lot from the Nightwing run, from what I understand, in the 90s and 2000s. But to me, this Black Mirror story makes the case that James Gordon Jr. should be always the definitive Dick Grayson villain. Such an interesting take, as essentially the sons of arguably the two most important male adult characters in the Batman mythos, in Jim Gordon and Bruce, and to have them posed against one another in this, you know, this diametrically opposed worldview is just a fascinating take. And like you said earlier, Frank Avila's art throughout this stuff with James Gordon Jr. is just blow away awesome. Jock's art on both interiors and one of my favorite Batman covers of all time, with the Joker smile made up of the bats and the blood against the moon and stuff.
Yeah.
Just outstanding.
And how great is Jock's Joker in general? Oh. That issue where Dick has to confront Joker in the, I think it's a subway tunnel, mm-hmm. where they end up, or a sewer, where they end up meeting up somewhere underground. It's so good. It's one of my favorite interpretations of the Joker visually.
I would completely agree. But yeah, you went through all of it so well, so I'd just add my little bit there. Black Mirror, surprisingly, my third favorite Batman story of all time, even ahead of you, which is stunning to me.
Yeah, I mean, this list was really difficult to put together because I had one prominent cut that I'll get to later, too, actually, and we'll just give them some mention later. But really, I had no doubt about my five, really, but it was the order of them. I could have rearranged this several different ways. Mm-hmm. I pretty much could have had everything except the Dark Knight Returns at one, just because I always like year one a little bit better. But nonetheless, my number two, I believe, may be your painting, Nick, because my number two comes to us as the spiritual successor to Batman Year One, but it comes to us from the creative team of Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale. My number two comic book is Batman The Long Halloween.
Indeed, it is my painting.
I'm going to let Nick drive this one for the most part. I will just say for my part, that Loeb and Sale pick up the pieces that Frank Miller left in Batman Year One and manage to even improve upon it by including Batman's incredible rogues gallery.
Absolutely. So this, to me, Long Halloween, there's a strong argument to be made that it is objectively the quintessential Batman story, because you have everything you could possibly, everything that makes the character of Batman the greatest character in comics. You have, as Greg mentioned, the deep rogues gallery. You have epic action at times. You have an intriguing mystery from the detective, you know, from the noir style detective investigation aspect of it. You have character building, what with Harvey Dent and James Gordon and Bruce Wayne all going through these changes over the course of the book. You've got the most visually distinct and yet not off-putting but great artistic interpretations of Batman's world ever in the case of Tim Sale. It looks totally unlike any other version of Batman that you've ever seen before, and yet it does not look so drastically different that it's impossible to process. It fits so well. His visual interpretation of the Joker with the overly large teeth, Batman with the humongous ears, it all sounds ridiculous in explanation, but when you see it on the page, it all works and it's all breathtaking. As I mentioned, the mystery, which genuinely keeps you on the edge of your seat the first time you're reading it, where you're trying to figure out which way it's going. It's got twists, it's got turns, it touches on, as you said, virtually every major contribution to the rogues gallery that there has been. It also introduces, or not introduces, but, you know, starts to popularize that idea of Batman and Catwoman being less antagonistic and more of a romantic relationship, something that writers have touched on in the decades since, and you and I both argue they should essentially be going all in on. This is kind of where it starts to become popularized in this. So many different things you could say about it. For me, it places so highly for all those reasons, but primarily, Batman's my favorite character in all of comics, and as I've said before, Two-Face, Harvey Dent, is my favorite villain of all of comics, and this, by far, is the best version of the Harvey Dent origin that has ever been put on the comics page, not just in terms of the actual acid scarring, but what makes Harvey Dent my favorite Batman villain, and I would argue one of the best villains in all of comics, is that deep personal connection that he and Bruce had, or he and Batman had beforehand. The added sense of guilt that Bruce has to feel, because not just did he let a man that he respected down, but he also let a man who was genuinely improving the city down. There was a path to doing things the right way, and it all fell apart because Bruce wasn't able to act soon enough. Outstanding stuff. Arguably, I would say, also one other thing about this is, Jeff Loeb is the only person, besides Frank Miller, who has ever incorporated the Falconis into a story, and it actually enhanced the Falconis rather than felt like it was detrimental to those characters' legacy. Just outstanding stuff from beginning to end. I am all in on the idea of an adaptation of this at some point. Let's hope it comes sooner rather than later, whether it be in animated form or perhaps a loose adaptation on the big screen.
It's also the book that, in many ways, informed the best Batman movie that we've gotten, which is The Dark Knight.
Right.
There were direct homages to this, even with the rooftop meeting between Batman, Gordon, and Two-Face in that movie, directly ties to The Long Halloween. So, such a great book. And the only thing I would add is that somebody needs to at some point do something interesting with Calendar Man again, because how could anyone read The Long Halloween and not come out of that thinking that Calendar Man is more than just a jobber villain?
Right.
you could do so much more with him. I was disappointed that no, you know, I had hoped that Scott Snyder used him, but he didn't really do much with him. And such a great ground floor laid here for that character, and so many others. Jeff Loeb is, in my opinion, even over Frank. Well, you can make the argument for Frank Miller, but to me, Jeff Loeb is the best Batman writer.
I would agree.
When you look at the best of his work, it's better than anybody's, and that's because it. Granted, he's doing a Frank Miller imitation in some ways, but he does it so well and incorporates the superheroics aspect of Batman. Which brings me to my number one favorite Batman story of all time. Notice I emphasize favorite and not best, because if I were trying to remove my emotional connection, if I were trying to remove my personal story of comics from this, I would probably have The Long Halloween at number one, and I'd probably have Year One at number two. But my number one Batman story of all time, the book that I would hand to anybody that isn't a Batman fan or that hasn't read a Batman comic and wants to get into the character, because I think it encompasses so much of what makes Batman great, is the 2002-2003 story Batman Hush by Jeff Loeb and Jim Lee.
The manager is rolling his eyes at this very moment.
I can hear the manager rolling his eyes. That's right, I can hear eyes somehow. I can hear the manager rolling his eyes, and I don't give a damn! I don't give a damn! I was trying to channel Sid there. Did it come off at all?
You did pretty well.
Yeah. We're live, pal. I understand the criticisms that this book gets. I don't agree with them, but I understand them. I think that there are, you know, you can nitpick this story, certainly. However, this is the story that brought me back into comics. We would not be doing this podcast right now, Nick, if it were not for Batman Hush. Because I don't think I ever would have gotten back into the world of comic books, at least full time. Certainly not enough to be doing a podcast on them. This is the story, that hooked me when I was a college student who had been away for 5 years from the world of comics and made me believe in them again, made me love them again, and made me, in particular, love Batman again. It was my favorite artist from when I was a kid, Jim Lee, who, of course, drew X-Men when I was a young man, and that was or a young boy, really. And that's what drew me to the comic, I'll be honest. I saw the cover with Batman, and I looked down. I didn't know who Jeff Loeb was, but I saw the name Jim Lee, and I said, I remembered that from when I was a kid. I was like, X-Men number one, Jim Lee. I had that. He was my favorite when I was a kid. I'm going to pick this up and see what it's like. And it was the beginning of that Hush storyline, and I never looked back. Hush is a story that is the best example of what I would call the greatest hits approach to a comic book run. This was Loeb and Lee knew they had 1 year on this character. They signed a 1 year contract to write and draw Batman. And what are you going to do if you have one crack at the character? You're going to try to use the entire Rogues Gallery. You're going to do everything that you're interested in doing in this story. It's crafted around a mystery that is so deep and so interwoven amongst the chapters, has so many twists and turns along the way, including one big one at the very end that I don't want to spoil for anyone that maybe hasn't read Hush yet.
The twist is too obvious.
I'm referring to the post-twist.
Ah, yes.
So that is the one that really – the other one, yeah, but that was the one that has still to this day really I love. And I think it's the best usage of that character to this point still, even over – well, you could argue that Scott Snyder did just as good of stuff with this character. But that was the last time before Snyder that anyone had done anything interesting with that character. So point being, Batman Hush distills down what makes Bruce Wayne tick. You've got that classic Jeff Loeb take on Batman. This could very easily be the same Batman that we read in Long Halloween and that we read in Dark Victory, because that's how Jeff Loeb writes him. He's more mature now. He's older. And it touches upon my favorite part of the Batman mythos, apart from the noir detective aspect. It touches on his relationships. I think that's what I love. That's what really turns me on, brother. about Batman comics, whether it be his relationship with Alfred, whether it be his relationship with Dick Grayson, Tim Drake, Barbara Gordon, his relationship with Superman. Nobody has ever written his relationship with Superman as well as Jeff Loeb. Not even close, in my opinion. And here we get that. We get him interacting with every major character that with whom he has interacted over the course of his 70-year history to this point. So this is a Batman story that gives you a greatest hits of villains. You get everyone from the Joker to Killer Croc to Poison Ivy to Harley Quinn to the Penguin to Two-Face. Everyone is here. Every major Batman villain is here, except I think Bane. You get every Batman ally that was around at this point. Tim Drake, Dick Grayson, Barbara, Alfred, Jim Gordon, Superman shows up, of course, with a great little crossover with Poison Ivy. And all of this is in the service of this mystery that's going on of who is Hush? What is Hush? You get the introduction of this brand new character of Tommy Elliott, who, yes, is a retconned character who's, quote, been there the whole time, but it's another good example of how to do this. A character who Bruce knew when he was a child, but that moved away later, and they didn't really have any relationship as adults. But they remembered each other as kids. And how that character sort of is an inverted version of what Bruce Wayne might have been. If Bruce's parents had been different, how might Bruce have turned out? And that's what we get with Tommy Elliott. It is a even better example than Nightfall. It takes the Nightfall example of somebody using the Rogues Gallery against Batman to break him down physically and mentally, and does it even on a greater scale, at least from an emotional standpoint for Batman. He's taken through the ringer here. And ultimately, there's no way, if we're talking about relationships in this story, Nick, that I can avoid talking about Batman and Catwoman. Mm-hmm. You talked about how Long Halloween helped popularize it to a degree. I would argue that Loeb takes it to the best level that it's ever been at in Hush.
Well, or quite frankly, certain other individuals have taken it further. But that's neither here nor there.
Yes, but not better. And that's what this is. This is, to this day, my favorite iteration of the Batman and Catwoman relationship. They don't have stupid nicknames for each other. They just love each other. And for the first time in his whole history, well, not the first time. There was stuff in the early 80s that did this too. But he lets her in terms of letting her know his identity, letting her become a part of him in a huge way, and saying, damn what anybody else thinks. So I really loved this version of Catwoman too. I think Loeb, really in general, DC Comics was doing great stuff with Catwoman at this point, but Loeb writes her so well, writes their relationship so well. Jim Lee, this is the other thing that I haven't even mentioned yet. Jim Lee draws the hell out of this. This is peak Jim Lee. This is beyond what he was doing on X-Men. This is beyond what he's doing today. This was the best version of Jim Lee. This and Superman for Tomorrow, you will not find better Jim Lee art. It is the best Batman visually I've ever seen. It's the best Batman Rose Gallery visually that I've ever seen. This will always be my favorite just because of how it brought me back into comics and what it did for me. And again, I think it's a story that's been imitated since then, but never duplicated. Batman Hush, my number one.
A controversial selection from Greg Phillips at number one.
Well, it's favorites. I'm not trying to be objective.
No. No, you're not. And while we're
you out here shitting on it, and you're about to vote for one that's not even as good as the one that comes before it. So don't even give me that.
In your misguided, short-sighted, irrelevant opinion.
In my correct opinion.
In your correct opinion. In any event, I will agree with you that Jeff Loeb is the greatest Batman writer. It's difficult to say that. I know most people would say, but Frank Miller, what with Dark Knight Returns in year one, and he would certainly be number two on that list.
Chris Sims would say, but Grant Morrison.
Yeah, he would, and he could go kill himself as a result of that opinion.
Good Lord! No, we don't mean that. That's
Anyway, but to me, it is Jeff Loeb. Whether it is the Superman-Batman run that I think you referenced earlier, the dynamic between those two being written, Hush, which just missed my list. I don't remember which cut it was, but it was definitely on my preliminary list. I'm a big fan of the story, as you are as well. Not quite as big a fan, but obviously that's because of an emotional attachment that you have to it, which there's nothing wrong with that, certainly. But for me, my favorite Jeff Loeb Batman story has always been, and it's difficult because I would like to cop out and count them as one story, but I really can't. And the reason I can't count them as one story is because they really are separate entities. But for my number one, I'm going to go with the sequel to The Long Halloween, that being Dark Victory. I talked a little bit earlier about how Long Halloween does the best version of the Two-Face origin that I've ever seen in comics. And then the sequel follows it up with the best version of Two-Face and Batman's first extended, you know, feud with one another here in the pages of Dark Victory. You know, the story opens with Harvey Dent, who is in Arkham, alongside some of the same people that he helped Batman to put away. And you have Bruce blaming himself for the current state of Harvey Dent. He is pulling away from people. He is becoming more and more of a loner. He is becoming more and more drastic in his methods. And it is here that Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale offer their take on the origin of the Batman and Robin dynamic. Now, I must admit, as massive of a Batman fan as I am, the idea of Kid Robbins has always been weird to me because of the street-level nature of the character. It always seems, if you're going to go darker and grittier and a little bit more grounded with it, it seems difficult to believe that a Batman would willingly bring a 10 or 11 or 12-year-old boy out into the streets of Gotham with him. But here, in the pages of Dark Victory, this gives you, to me anyway, the best version of Dick Grayson's origin story that I've read. It gives you the best justification for Batman taking the action of bringing on a Robin due to the mindset he was in at the time. And on top of all of that that I just mentioned, once again, you have Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale delving into the rogues gallery the only the way they can, picking up loose threads with the Falcone family and the Holiday Killer, picking up a loose thread with the Riddler, who played somewhat of a major role in Long Halloween, but is back here to play an even larger role in Dark Victory. So really, what you have here in Dark Victory is yet another story that really incorporates all the best elements of Batman. The rogues gallery, the action, the supporting cast, and of course, telling a detective story on a superhero level the way that no other character in comics can really do. It's another intriguing mystery. You wrap all that up with a great, ongoing power struggle between he and Harvey Dent. My favorite Batman story of all time. Anytime you can feature Two-Face, you're going to have a leg up. And when you throw in Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale, puts it over the top for me.
Yeah, I mean, I knew this would be your number one. This has been your favorite for since I've known you. Really, this has been your favorite Batman story. I obviously don't hold it quite in as high esteem as The Long Halloween, but I do like it. I think it's a great Two-Face story in particular. One day we'll get into our thoughts, our complete full thoughts on the Batman and Robin dynamic and how it's done in comics, and because I have what I believe our esteemed co-hosts of Talkin' Pop would call complex Batman and Robin feelings. Because as much as Dick Grayson is my favorite character in comics, but I'm not necessarily in love with the concept of Robin, if that makes sense. Although here he is good, and this is probably the best version of that Batman and Robin origin story, in my view anyway, that I've seen. So good stuff. Batman Dark Victory, great addition to the Loeb and Sale universe. And there's also that third collection of Loeb and Sale Batman stories, Haunted Night, that's really good as well, that are more kind of like scattershot stories.
Right. It's not really one cohesive narrative.
Right. But that's all good stuff, too. Mm-hmm. So certainly an argument could be made for them as the greatest Batman creative team on a a seemingly never-ending list of great Batman creative teams, right?
Right.
All right. Well, before we go to the break, we will remind you of our lists. And at 5, I had The Black Mirror. At 4, I had The Dark Knight Returns. At 3, I had Batman Year One. At 2, I had The Long Halloween. And at 1, I had Hush. Nick?
At 5, I had The Court of Owls and Night of the Owls. I had at 4, I had The Dark Knight Returns. 3, The Black Mirror. 2, The Long Halloween. And number 1, Dark Victory.
As for those that just missed the cut, for me, I had Batman Endgame. And I had, what was the other one that just missed the cut? Ah, yes, my very last one that I cut was Nightfall. I really wanted to put Nightfall on here. I loved that era of Batman. And that story was my favorite Batman story as a kid. And it just missed the cut. Any missed the cut for you, Nick?
Year One would be the most notable one. Hush would be up there. My Two-Face fandom really wanted me to put Face the Face on the list. If it had been a top ten, it would have been in there towards the back end, but I couldn't justify a place in the top five for it. But if you're looking for great Two-Face stories, not by Jeff Loeb or Tim Sale, check out Face the Face. It picks up right after the aftermath of 1 year later, which came after right after Infinite Crisis, kind of fills in some of the gaps there, and also is probably the best modern Two-Face story.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, we know that with all the great Batman stories out there, we probably left some off that you guys wanted us to throw some lip service to. So send us those lists. Get on Twitter. Tweet us at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Shoot us an email, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com, or join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and leave us your lists there of the best Batman stories. We want your 5 best. Rank them. Give them to us. And we actually want your favorites. Don't go by what you think the critics would approve. Go by what you like the best in Batman. And then we will either praise or mock you right here on the show next week. So, with that being said, we are going to take a break. And when we come back on the other side, we've got reading, we've got watching, we've got the rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place for Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. And we now offer them to you on 2 great feeds. On the Place for Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB in Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post-Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlaceStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in all the Place to Be Nation.
That wasn't so bad, Nick.
No, it wasn't.
We're Greg and Nick. We are Venom. And we are back to bring you all the latest news and notes in the world of comic books. It's a little segment. You might even say it's a little segment that we like to call The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown, where we talk some comic news. Welcome to The Rundown, where we talk about movies too.
Well, to start things off on The Rundown, Nick, we have to go back into that oft-used corner of the studio.
One more time. Yep.
That corner of the studio known as the Worlds of DCEU Corner.
Mm-hmm.
Worlds of DCEU Corner.
Because we got some news for you, folks.
We do.
Hot off the presses.
Late breaking news here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys.
And leading us off on that late breaking news is that director Matt Reeves' upcoming movie, The Batman, finally has a release date. That release date, June 25th of 2021.
Oh.
And buried in this story in Variety, not buried, three paragraphs in actually, in this story in Variety, is that Ben Affleck will not be returning to play the Caped Crusader. Finally, confirmation that Ben Affleck's run as Batman has come to an end. In addition, in another interview somewhere else, Matt Reeves talked about his take that it would focus on the detective side of Batman and that it would include a rogues gallery of villains.
Oh.
And
that's exciting because I think a lot of Batman's rogues gallery has been established in the public consciousness to this point that you don't really need to have one primary villain. Like, you can incorporate multiple villains for different portions of the film and it'd be okay. And that sounds like an interesting take to me.
It can be. It's also a risk, as we've seen in other movies that have tried to do that with multiple Batman villains. It's really very rarely been done successfully.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to see what he does. But I do like it as well. It's different, and it's more comic book-like, and hopefully means that we're going to be avoiding the trap of trying to tell multiple villain origins in one movie.
Right, right.
So that's compelling. I'm excited about the detective side of Batman. I would expect perhaps a little bit of influence from the Arkham video games to come in, maybe.
Let's
that would
so.
Be cool.
Further DC, Worlds of DCEU Corner news, in the same story, reports that there's also a release date for The Suicide Squad. So apparently, if you want to reboot something now, you just put the word "the" in front of it, and that signifies that it's different than what came before. So the studio has dated a rebooted The Suicide Squad, which James Gunn is in talks to direct. He's already writing the script, and that's for August 6th, 2021. So Batman in June of 2021, Suicide Squad in August of 2021, and somewhere else is reporting that in May of 2021, we're getting, hold on to your hat, Stephanie Holly, DC Super Pets is coming in May of 2021.
Wow, and coming in May of 2019 is an announcement of a rescheduling of these movies to make them farther apart.
Oh, hey man, it would be kind of cool for DC to get their stuff together and actually start cranking these movies out, but I believe it when I see it.
Yeah, I agree. And also, let's be honest, this feels like that post-Wonder Woman jubilation that came from Warner Brothers, where they made a bunch of announcements on the heels of Wonder Woman being great, and now that Aquaman has been a big success, they're making all these announcements. Let's see what happens if Shazam somehow comes out and flops, or gosh, what's the next one after that? Joker?
Oh, yeah, Joker, and then Wonder Woman 84.
Well, we'll have to see, but Warner Brothers, we're going to leave the DC Worlds of DCEU corner now and go back over here to our...
Well, actually, before we do that, let's call an audible here. There's one more DCEU-related item on our rundown that we need to go ahead and hit before we leave the corner.
Oh, tell me more.
Well, it was the first footage of let me get this title right. Let me make sure I got the full thing right. The first teaser footage from Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. It's literally just like a 15-second image or a little teaser of like different images of the various characters, but it does give us our first look at Huntress, at Ewan McGregor's Black Mask, obviously not in the actual Black Mask, but
Renee Montoya,
the Black Canary, and of course the titular or Brestular Harley Quinn herself. So not a ton of footage to dissect, but at least a look at the visual aesthetic for these characters.
Yes, it is, Nick, and I will say I've said a lot of mean things about Suicide Squad over these last 2 years. I did miss seeing Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn, I have to admit.
You ain't kidding. And, you know, it looks like this movie will not be without a plethora of decent imagery. We'll put it that way.
Fair,
decent, not too shabby.
And I would include Ewan McGregor in that.
There you go. He's no Liam Neeson, of course, but then again, no, who is?
Who is?
No one.
Dr. Manhattan is no Liam Neeson.
Now that is the casting we need for the HBO Watchmen show. And it's literally just Liam Neeson, but they just put blue body paint on him like in Watchmen or Rorschach. And the camera
staring at?
And the camera just keeps panning down and zooming in the entire time. And he's like, hey, up here. Eyes up front, buddy.
If you stop staring at my massive cock, no harm will come to you.
But if you keep staring at it, some harm will come to you. The kind that's, you know, some harm that you might kind of like, you know?
I have a particular set of skills.
Speaking of which, you know, and we're going wildly off topic, but while I was finding...
Are we
going
to talk about Cold Pursuit?
No, we're going to talk about something else. So while I was finding... The place where I found that gift, Greg, that I shared in our ultra-exclusive Place to Be Nation Pop Comics group chat earlier... was on this forum that traffics in celebrity rumors. Did you know that there's a rumor going around, apparently for years, that I didn't even know about, that Bradley Cooper took a ride on Liam Neeson's cock?
No.
Yes. That's a rumor that's out there, apparently.
That's weird.
Apparently during... And they'll have you believe it happened during the filming of The A-Team.
So you're telling me that a young and in his prime Bradley Cooper... took a ride on, you know, all due respect to the one of my favorite actors, but old man Liam Neeson's giant dong.
The sheer mechanics of it are what I'm trying to figure out. I mean, good Lord.
I mean, more power to him, I guess. But like, you would think that Bradley Cooper, you know, could have certainly walked over to, you know, Quentin Rampage Jackson on the set of that.
That's
movie
true.
Or something.
That's
you
true.
Know, like. Or could have walked over to who else was in that movie? Who played Face in that movie? Bradley Cooper did. Who played Hannibal in that movie?
Liam Neeson
did. Who played the other guy? Was there
the other guy? Yeah, there's Face, there's Hannibal, there's BA, and then there's
Howlin' Mad Murdoch. Yeah.
There you go.
So
I don't remember.
Charlton Copley, right? Charlton Copley.
The point being. You know, if we're wondering about Liam Neeson's cock in the future, I think we have to ask Bradley Cooper.
Do you think we can get him on our show?
I mean, God, why wouldn't we be able to, given as we'll talk about later, given the massive amount of influence we now wield in the entertainment industry?
You know, but really, we're the talent. It's not our job to book guests. That's the job of the manager.
That's a great point. That's one of the best points
ever made.
He lives
out in California.
Yep. So, Todd, get on that. We need Bradley Cooper on the air and see if you can get him to confirm or deny that he has experienced the Evian bottle, as Janice Dickinson refers to it.
I tell you what, right now I'm going to go into our exclusive chat while we're on the air right now, and I'm going to at Todd Weber. I'm going to say, we need the manager to get Bradley Cooper booked on HTF.
Yes.
Back me up on that, Nick, when the time comes. So, in any event, is that all we're doing on this? Have we exhausted this running joke now?
I suppose so. What were we even talking about?
We were about to move out of the DCEU corner or what has now become Liam Neeson's corner. And we are going to move on to the story coming out that a Batman Beyond animated movie is reportedly in the works. This is coming, of course, on the heels of the massive success of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And DC and Warner Brothers, according to a report from Geeks Worldwide, which if you can't trust them, who can you trust?
Hubba, 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 who can you trust?
Warner Animation Group is set to begin work on a Batman Beyond film targeting a 2022 release date. And yeah, that's pretty much all we have on it right now. I'm reading the story here, and
there's a little bit of concept art.
Concept art that's leaked out, apparently, which I can't see on this. But nonetheless, what do you think, Nick? Batman Beyond movie.
Yeah, especially if it's an animated movie, so that it's not like they're moving towards this as the, you know, live action interpretation for the next several years. Just a
I don't like this concept art.
A different take. I'm not going to overreact.
But we can't judge it. We can't judge it because we didn't like the concept.
I was about to say, that's exactly what I was about to say. We hated the Spider-Verse art, so we'll have to wait and see how it plays.
I will say I don't ever understand the decision for anyone to go with the Nightwing red costume, unless that wasn't Nightwing that I was just staring at. Let me see here.
Well, I mean, the Batman Beyond costume is
red. Yeah, it looks like the Batman Beyond costume. Yeah. It's just when I first looked at it, I thought it was the Nightwing logo. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah. So this could be awesome. I mean, now that Spider-Verse has set the bar and is the bar, certainly this movie has something to aspire for. And hopefully it could match Spider-Verse hold for hold.
I'll echo Kevin Smith's dream casting as well. Michael Keaton for the voice of old Bruce Wayne. How awesome would that be?
Yes. That would be perfect, actually. If he would agree to do it. And why wouldn't he?
Yeah, I hope this happens. You're lower on the concept of Batman Beyond than I am. But,
yes, always have been. You know that.
I'm for it.
I was never a huge Batman Beyond fan, but not everything has to be for me. And after Into the Spider-Verse, there's never been a better time to do an alternate take on a superhero in animated form.
Right.
Let's see it. Let's do it. Now, let's move from there to this feller here from Doctor Who. Matt Smith, a former doctor. Is that what they're called on the show there?
Sure. I don't watch the fucking show.
Matt Smith, has been cast in Sony's Morbius film. Mm. This also according to Variety, which is breaking all sorts of stuff lately.
Now here's a concept that you're higher on than I am.
Yes. Jared Leto was previously confirmed to be cast in the Brestular role. Mm-hmm. And it will be included in the Sony Spider-Verse alongside Venom. Mm-hmm. No details on what character Smith may be playing, but I don't know any Michael Morbius supporting characters anyway, so who am I to say? Perhaps Dracula. I don't know. I made that up. But
some sort of vampire you have to assume, right?
You would have to assume. Probably the villain. Vampire hunter, maybe. An evil vampire hunter.
Oh, yeah. But the villain. I mean, you would think you got the lead, you've got his love interest, and now you need the villain.
Yes. So, Morbius appears to be happening.
I'm no Morbius fan, so this is a weird one to be. I mean, we'll see how it turns out, I guess.
Well,
your thoughts. You know what, Nick? What are your thoughts?
I'm fine with it. I think there's potential in a Morbius movie. I'm not some giant, you know, Michael Morbius fan. I've never bought a Morbius comic in my life.
It is well known that you are a lover of three things, Greg.
Here we go.
Michael Morbius, Jeff Jarrett, and the Intercontinental title.
And hey, has the stock ever been higher for Jeff Jarrett than it is right now?
No, nor has the cholesterol.
Well, Jeff's old. He's older now. He's had his day, you know. He needed a moment, but he looked better on Raw. He looked better on Raw than he did at the Rumble.
Yes, when he wasn't bearing his stomach, he looked better.
He wasn't wearing the old whatever weird suit that was he wore in the early 90s.
Yep. Anyway,
that's neither here nor there.
But, by the way, neither time when he did the J-E-double-F, J-A-double-R-E-double-T, did he finish it with a ha-ha.
I know. Nor did they artificially impose the ding little white sparkle of his teeth.
Right.
That's something they can work on in the future. But, nonetheless,
clean it up in post.
I'm okay with a Morbius movie. I think there's potential there. Mm-hmm. Again, I thought Venom was fun, and hopefully Morbius would be fun. If not, then I don't think the Spider-Verse will go very far beyond Venom. In any event.
You're not ready for the Kraven the Hunter movie or the Sinister Six movie? How are you going to make a Sinister Six movie without Spider-Man?
Well, some said, how are you going to make a Venom movie without Spider-Man?
Venom at least has a history of being,
yes, know, that's true.
Decent stories told from an anti-hero perspective. I'm not aware of such a thing existing for the Sinister Six.
No. Well, the Sinister Six, by its nature, is a villainous group. It is very difficult, nigh impossible, to make a movie where a villainous group are the protagonists. Mm-hmm. Because by their nature, you have to root for Spider-Man or Venom or whoever to defeat them, right?
Yes.
Theoretically.
In theory.
But now we're getting both the Joker and the Sinister Six. But you know, Nick, every now and again, we get to talk about a story that validates the power and the authority that our show, the Hard Traveling Fanboys, exercises over the world of multimedia, and particularly the world of comics. And Nick, this is just one of those stories that indicates that our show and our words, our intellectual, philosophical, thought-provoking words, are reaching the ears of the power players in the world of comics. Because it appears that the executives at DC Comics and Warner Brothers have been listening to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Because just this week, we got a massive update from the DC Universe app, an app that we have been highly critical of in recent months here on our show. And they have just added thousands of new comic book titles to the DC Universe subscription service. And it's just part of what the company says will more than double the total available titles by the end of March. They have uploaded, this is just a few of the collections they've uploaded, the Rebirth era of Action Comics, the New 52 Batman, Batman Incorporated, The War of Jokes and Riddles, Flashpoint, Gotham Central, the 2011 and 2013 Harley Quinn runs, Justice League Dark Side War, The Omega Men, Alan Moore's entire Swamp Thing run, Static Shock, Superman for All Seasons, Wonder Woman issues that aren't specified in this book. There are so many stories here, Nick, that we are going to add to our list of Long Book Hunters episodes. Very exciting news. They have also said on their forums they are not planning to subtract anytime soon. So it looks like, and yes, there were surveys that were sent out, but I have it on good authority, Nick. My sources tell me that those surveys were not consulted, that the decision was made purely because we complained about it on our show repeatedly.
Yes, we are now the primary. You know what we are, Greg? We are social media influencers. That's what we are.
We're influencers. I think we need to take part in the next Fire Festival.
Mm. Or we can start our own festival. Which of course, the main event of that festival will be the Danse Obese.
The Danse Obese, yes. Nick, this is very exciting news, though. In all seriousness, I am stoked about the greater value now in the DC Universe app. Finally, they are adding in all of these comic book runs, these classic runs, a lot of them, and they appear to be beginning the wheels moving on, hopefully, what will bring an end to that curated run and make it what it needs to be, which is a hub for all things DC. And as far as I'm concerned, if they keep doing this, they could lose all the TV and video content, and I would still be getting my money's worth.
Absolutely. To me, the value in the service was always in the comics content if it was going to be DC's answer to Marvel Unlimited. It's still not there yet, but at least the change in approach is a good thing. So let's hope they continue to go further and further down this road and never again return to the curated era.
Any of these additions in particular stand out to you as something you want to delve into?
I would have to look at the list again. I haven't singled out any in particular, but like I said, I'm more excited by the change in mindset than anything else.
Very good. And I'm still holding out hope they're going to upload that JLA pilot too, speaking of multimedia content, because we'll be hitting that one up too. So good on DC for the changes mentioned here. And speaking of the DC Universe app, Titans, a show that we've talked about here on the show, debated a little bit, enjoyed to different degrees, but a report came out this week that Deathstroke, Jericho, and Ravager, those of course being Deathstroke's children, are coming to DC Universe's Titans. Citing a casting call from an unnamed source, it says that the Titans is casting all three roles, seeking a Latino, Asian, or Caucasian male, 40 to 55, to play Deathstroke, while they are reportedly seeking the same an actress at 18 to 21 to play Ravager. So this is pretty awesome, Nick. I'm stoked to see Deathstroke in another form come to television. We've already, of course, gotten an excellent Deathstroke.
The casting process for this should be extremely short. It should be about 45 seconds long. Call Manu Bennett, ask him if he'll do it. That's your casting process.
Yes, I agree. We've already gotten a great Deathstroke, but regardless, I'm excited to see this character come onto the small screen again with Ravager, with Jericho, and with his predominant comic book villains, the Teen Titans, or the Titans in this case. So, yeah, this is awesome. I mean, with the way that Titans does its fight scenes, Deathstroke should be awesome.
Should be, yes. My only concern now is those are three characters that you're going to have to set up and tell a compelling story with while also wrapping up your story from season one that you didn't finish. So I am concerned now that in a 10-episode or 11-episode format that you'll be pressed for time somewhat. But hopefully the second season will resolve some of the pacing issues that I had with the first season.
Right. Well, to wrap things up, we've got a little bit of casting news from the upcoming CW Batwoman show, and that is that, let's see, we've got the casting of Luke Fox, a.k.a. Batwing, on Batwoman. Luke Cage's Camrys Johnson will play Luke Fox, the son of Lucius Fox. And additionally to him, Teen Wolf's Megan Tandy will play Kate Kane's one-time military colleague and lover, Sophie Moore, who is now a high-level private security agent, one of Gotham's staunchest protectors. And finally, Yu's Nicole Kang will be playing Kate Kane's stepsister, Mary Hamilton. So the pilot is being filmed right now for consideration as a fall 2019 series on the CW. It almost assuredly will be a fall 2019 series on the CW. If they don't, then they're even more foolish than they were when they didn't do that Aquaman show. So, thoughts on this, Nick?
I'm excited, especially about the introduction of Batwing. You know, I'm no great fan of his in the comics, but if you're going to operate in a landscape without Batman, it makes sense to introduce other less popular members of the Bat family as we go forward. And Batwing seems to make a lot of sense as, you know, Kate is going to need her own supporting cast. Without Lucius in the picture, Luke makes a lot of sense. So this seems cool. I'm down for this.
Could you see them introducing someone like a Harper Row on here as well?
Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah. And they could introduce Liam Neeson as Batwing.
As Batwing. Yes, that's true.
Well, with that being said, we're going to move on from the rundown, and we are going to head over to a section where we talk about what we've been reading and watching. It's a segment that we and you all love to call Reading and Watching. What you been reading and watching? Nick, what you been reading?
Nothing.
I have read a comic book in the last 7 days.
I heard that. I heard this rumor. They said this at the airport.
At the airport?
Yes.
Yeah, they told you so at the airport when they were talking to you about talking WCW, no doubt.
Mm.
And they said, hey, I heard you also have a friend that has recently read a comic book. And I have.
Yeah.
I read the – now I'm a few months behind, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
I read the Jeff Johns and Dale Eaglesham comic Shazam number 1, which of course is the launch of a new ongoing starring Earth's Mightiest Mortal, who is referred to at not actually he's not actually referred to as Shazam in this comic. They actually play around with it. They hauntingly tease our old friend at Captain Marvel Talk, Nick, because at one point he's trying to think of what to call themselves and he's like, we'll all have to call ourselves something different. Like, I don't know, maybe I could be Captain. What if I was called Captain Mar, and then he's interrupted by someone? So,
well, our good friend at Captain Marvel Talk has committed, you know, like internet suicide or something. He's gone.
Oh, well. Oh, well. C'est la vie. C'est la vie. But in any event, this was a really good comic, Nick, as you might expect from Jeff Johns. It does a great job. I don't know the first thing about the new 52 version of Shazam. I didn't know who all this new Marvel family is. I didn't realize that Mary was his foster sister instead of his real sister. But nonetheless, Johns and Eaglesham do an amazing job of introducing all these characters in one issue. And there's actually a great backup about Mary Marvel in here. And I can't remember the artist's name on the backup, but that was really good too, kind of showing how she came to join this foster family. And so between these two issues in an issue, I thought it was excellent. It was one of the best debut issues I've read in a while. Johns instantly has me hooked on this concept of the Marvel family, the Shazam family, I should say, and what they're going to be like going forward. We also get a nice little twist reveal at the end that was kind of reminiscent of some other great twists in comics past, like when Peter's parents show up at the door in Spider-Man, or when Barry Allen shows up at Wally West's door back in the Mark Wade version of The Flash. So really good stuff here all around, Nick. Look forward to you reading it one day.
I look forward to it as well.
And that's it. That's all I've read.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's move over to watching.
Mm-hmm.
Monday night gave us the return of our beloved show, Arrow.
Let me just say up front, I am behind on Black Lightning, so I will not be covering
me
that
too.
During
I
this.
Will not be talking about Black Lightning either.
Right.
So, that is not a comment on the quality of Black Lightning. I'm just too far behind right now. I'll probably have to wait till the end of the season and binge it on Netflix.
And by that, he means never actually watch it.
No, I'll watch it. I like Black Lightning. I enjoy it. I'm invested in the story. But nevertheless, I fell behind due to wrestling and other stuff. So, Arrow is back from its hiatus. And in this episode, we get to meet Emiko Queen. And she's awesome.
I love this. I love this because you're hesitating because I'm assuming you've already watched the episode of Arrow that we're not talking about and you've got your wires crossed again.
No, I haven't yet, actually.
Oh, wow.
I was just trying to remember the deets of the episode. But also the name was not pronounced exactly the way that I thought it would be.
Yeah, Emiko. It's pronounced Emiko.
Emiko.
And we've always pronounced it Emiko, but I don't know if that's I'm not really sure if that's a fault of us or a fault of the show. Like I don't know what the proper phonetic pronunciation of that is.
I told our friend Russell Sellers over the weekend that I suspect this could become the next Ra's/Ra's al Ghul.
Yes.
Where everybody pretty much pronounces it differently.
Right.
And sometimes inconsistently in the same medium.
Yeah, so, but I mean, it's weird though, because like I've never heard anybody pronounce it this way. Like pretty much anybody I've ever heard talk about the character has always pronounced it the way we do. So this is interesting to have a different pronunciation. Maybe it's something they'll like. Remember when the first Venom trailer came out and Jenny Slate was pronouncing
Symbiote?
Maybe they'll just kind of quietly change it over
perhaps
time.
We can get Jeff Lemire on the show to let us know what
if he's ever ridden Liam Neeson's cock.
Yeah, we could ask him that. Okay. Nick, is your microphone still plugged in?
Yes.
Okay, good. You sounded like you faded out for a moment there, even though we're sitting right next to each other here in the studio, of course. Mm-hmm. So, the L-shaped studio, that is. We get to meet Emiko in this episode, who is an older version of the character that we know from the comics, but yet she's a badass, an absolute badass. And we find out about Robert Queen's sort of less than scrupulous past, shall we say? And that he has a second family
that he sets up in the crappy part of town, so he can go over there and, you know, basically ball this lady
as much as he wants,
and not have to worry about his rich family coming to the rough part of town.
Robert Queen was a dick.
Yes. Oh, Robert Queen.
So, Robert Queen, you cad. But it's all right. He killed himself in the end, so it made up for it.
Yeah, he killed himself, and then he left. He's like, I'm going to kill myself, and I'm going to leave each of my children a list of people I would also like them to kill.
To kill? Nick, are you keeping a list that you want your children, of people you want your children to kill when they get older?
God, yes. You know, I've been keeping a list like that before I even had kids.
just stowing it away in case.
Just in case.
in case daddy dies, break glass.
Take vengeance upon these people, even though they had nothing to do with my death. My death was actually caused by years of alcohol and food abuse, and not by any of these people, but they're shitty people, so they need to die. Or they're not shitty people, but I just don't like them because I'm a shitty person, whichever.
So, yes, Emiko has been left her own list of people that she's trying to go through.
I think the implication of the episode is that she created the list herself.
Yes, she created the list of people that she wants to get revenge on for the death of her mother.
Right.
She actually doesn't want anything to do with Oliver or the rest of them, and that's why she's never introduced herself to him, even though she knew clearly of him existing, and she knows who her father was. She has issues of her own to work through, and she is currently trying to work through those by getting revenge on the guy that she thinks is responsible for that. Of course, as the mystery unfolds, it turns out that maybe she didn't have the story completely right, as she thought she did. Mm-hmm. But this episode hooks her up with a guy that's been helping her all season, which is Wild Dog, a.k.a. Renee. He actually finds purpose in helping her out, and he brings in Curtis as well. But really, it's about bonding between Renee and Emiko, and I really enjoyed that whole part of the episode. I've made no secret of the fact that Wild Dog's a character that I had no time for when he was introduced, but I think they have done an amazing job of rounding him out over the last couple seasons, to me, far more than they've done with the other new Team Arrow people. And I'm compelled by this aspect. Emiko was great. I was a little uncomfortable with her being attractive, because I think of Emiko as a kid, but in the comics, you know. Mm-hmm. But she was a badass. And then you've got, at the same time, Oliver and Felicity discovering the existence of Emiko. Mm-hmm. And Oliver having to deal with what a colossal dick his dad was, which is something that I think, if you think about it, Nick, in the last few seasons, really over the course of the last six seasons, Oliver has sort of come to terms in many ways with the bad things that his father did, and had grew to almost have this reverence for him, that his father sacrificed things for Oliver, that his father loved him and loved his sister and loved his family. Well, now it turns out he had a whole separate family, and it's about as bad a thing as you can do. So now everything that Oliver believed about his dad has been thrown out the window. His dad was a shitty person, and his mom was a shitty person, because his mom is the one that made sure that Emiko and her mom never got the support that Robert wanted them to have when he died. So
it's they didn't say this, but it was like, yeah, he had Walter take care of him. Remember Walter? Remember that guy who was on the show for like four seasons?
I know. I halfway thought that they were going to bring Walter onto the show and like say, we're going to talk to Walter about it. But Walter now plays General Zod on Krypton.
Oh.
So, So I guess they can't get him back on the show, but he was a good character too. They need to get him back if they can at some point, just as a cameo.
Yeah,
but yeah, Walter. I remember Walter, and he hasn't been on since what, season two? So
didn't they get married, Walter and his mom, or did they just date or whatever? I don't remember.
Yeah, but remember his mom dies at the end of season two.
That's right, but wasn't Walter around in season three, like for a little while?
I don't remember.
It's been a long time.
It's been a while. Suffice to say, all this stuff was great. And then in the future version, we continue to
terrible wigs.
The worst wig you will ever see in your life on Renee. I mean, just a brutally bad wig.
And like, the thing about it is, at least with Dinah, they gave her a little makeup to put some wrinkles on her face and like some bags under her eyes. Basically, with Renee, they took him and they were like, all right, put a suit on. Now here's this terrible wig. Drop it on top.
And his perfect. Big scar is reduced somehow.
It's the worst of the aged up makeup they've done for any of the characters to this point.
Yeah, like, he still looks like the same guy.
He looks like the same wig. Person. With a stupid, like, 50-50, like, salt and pepper wig, you know?
But it's a weird, really weird a twist that I didn't see coming, that Renee is actually working with this corrupt organization that is sort of planning the destruction of Star City.
I am under the assumption that the ultimate reveal is going to be Felicity is still alive somehow, and she and Renee were reaching across the aisle together to work together.
Hopefully so. Yeah, it's very interesting. The whole thing is interesting. The episode was great. And I always love – I'm like you, I guess, at this point. I like seeing Oliver go through pain and have to process
pain,
his worldview being
suffering.
Challenged. Yeah, so what did you think of this one, Nick?
Liked it.
That's all you got?
I liked it. I've been commenting all along. What do you want me to say? It's good. It's Arrow.
I want you to talk about whether you think that – this is saying something greater about the nature of comic books or comic book TV shows, or about, indeed, Green Arrow's rich 70-year history, and maybe as a way of combining every version of Green Arrow there's ever been into one.
No.
What about Dante Macabre?
No, Dante Obese. We've been over this.
Oh, that's good. All right, so...
You can't have a Dante Obese in the CW, though, on the CW universe, because there are no obese characters. Obesity...
Their version of obese is Captain Lance, who was just had a normal body.
Obesity has been eradicated in the CW-verse.
Flash will probably introduce Chunk, and he'll just look like a normal guy.
He'll look like a normal guy. My God, look how morbidly fat he is. He could die at any moment.
Vince McMahon comes by.
God.
Anyway. Now, speaking of The Flash, yes. Vince McMahon did not appear on The Flash.
Sadly.
It was Tuesday, last Tuesday, that we got the unwelcome return of the Cicada storyline.
Cicada, Cicada, who gives a shit? No one.
And Cicada ends up stabbing Nora, and it predicts it shows Barry have to deal with his daughter being injured and how that will affect him.
And that was okay. And we got some more.
Yeah, all that stuff was fine.
We got some more advancement of the Sherlock investigating Nora stuff, including Iris trying to protect her daughter from what she perceives as Sherlock's prying, even though it's justified at this point. But my God, dude, like.
Oh, the Cicada stuff was the worst it's ever been.
This was the worst performance Chris Klein has given the entire season, which is saying something. And it wasn't helped by the fact that, like, I don't even know what that character's name is, but the stupid Snake Eye guy is almost as bad an actor as Chris Klein, and they brought him back and gave him a ton of screen time. You know, again, it's the same old thing with The Flash this season. All of the Allen family drama stuff is interesting, and basically everything else isn't.
Let me tell you, at the risk of playing into the cliche of The Flash as a concept, I'm losing patience with this Cicada crap. They need to move on from this and move on to what's going on with Thawne, because that's what's interesting.
Yes.
That's all I care about at this point from a villain perspective. I don't want no more of this. I'm going to go ahead and say this, Nick. Remember that guy that played Vertigo, the first Vertigo that I used to criticize all the time on Arrow because I thought he was a shitty actor and you defended him? I'd like to retroactively change my opinion.
Okay.
And the reason that I'd like to retroactively change my opinion is I didn't know bad acting until I saw this.
Yes.
Because Chris Klein gave one of the worst performances I've seen on television on a major show. It was atrocious. It was irredeemably atrocious.
As our esteemed colleague Ben Morrison on Twitter, when the Flash finally wraps up its run, the ranking of Flash big bads will go something like Thawne, Zoom, Thinker, Savitar. Every big bad they have between now and the end of the season of the series, and then Cicada dead last.
Yes, he is the dirt worst.
The
Nick.
Dirt. This acting is. Worse.
I legitimately believe you could take you or I or even yes. our friend Jeremy Reynolds, who hates Chris Klein even more than we do, and he could have delivered those lines with more conviction than what Chris Klein did. His generic, horrible. Ugh, I'm a bad guy voice and, was so laughably bad that it would have been out of place on Raw.
And the sad thing is, like, you know, you can't say with 100% certainty, but even if they had gotten a good performance, this character is so thinly written that, like,
yep.
I don't even understand what the writers think the appeal of it is. I understand they don't want to go back to the well too often with speedster villains, and I appreciate that, but... Why have we not gotten a Rogue season yet? Like, the Rogues is the big bad, you know? That's arguably the most iconic villainous concept in all of Flash history, and here we are 5 years in, we can't get a damn Rogue season.
Iconic! yeah, I don't know. There's no defending it. Anyway, let's say, what is, Supergirl... I did not watch this week, actually.
No.
So, not yet. I was just trying to think about that. I have not watched Supergirl this week yet. But, Nick, you watched it, I'm sure.
I did. It was all right. It focuses a little too heavily on Naya, who is not a character that I'm overly invested in. But perhaps there are other people who are, so maybe that's good for them. It also furthers the new dynamic between Kara and Alex, that I don't want to give away too much about that. After the events of last week's episode and the new status quo for them. So a fine episode, but I think it's a little bit of a step back from the recent run of episodes they've been on.
Now, how does Nia compare here to Nia Jax?
About 20% of Nia Jax, I would think.
Very good. Very good.
Well, on the Nate Milton scale, she would probably be about a 3 compared to the 11 that Nia Jax is.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, that about wraps up this, but I guess we should rank them. I only have 2 to rank, and I would go Arrow and The Flash.
And I would go Arrow. Oh, God. I'll go Arrow, Flash, Supergirl, just because the Allen stuff was so good that it was better than anything on Supergirl, but Supergirl did not reach anywhere near the depths of the bottoms that that Flash did.
Look at you, Chris Klein. How can you even look at yourself in the mirror?
Go on, get.
Yeah, get. You look at yourself and say, that can't be me with the fake villain voice and the non-convincing delivery. That's not fair.
Go ahead.
Life sucks, and then you die.
Well done.
It may be my... It's on the short list of my favorite... promos in the history of this business. It's amazing. That can't be me with the pot belt, the pot belly, and the small genitalia. That's not fair. Oh, small genitalia. Anyway.
Oh.
Yep. Yep. So, that's the end of the reading reading and watching. So, next week, I said so 455,000 times in this podcast. next week will be the return of hard-traveling fangirl Jennifer Smith to the show, as she will be joining us to take a look at Ant-Man and the Wasp, which have just been added to Netflix. This will be, of course, the latest installment of Hard Travelers for Hire. So be on the lookout for that. Nick, what else we got coming the folks' way? We doing something special for Valentine's Day?
No.
not the return of heart traveling fanboys?
Well, that's kind of what this month usually is. February, we dedicate to things that we outright love. So, like, we gave you our five favorite Batman stories today. Tentatively for Off the Page, we have planned to do a look back at a movie that Greg and I both unabashedly love and many others have complex feelings about. That, of course, being the original entry in the worlds of DCEU, Man of Steel. So we're going to take a look back at that one, which we haven't done in some time. I'm looking forward to that. And then we called an audible to incorporate a little wrestling content into the podcast coming up at the end of the month. But we'll cross that bridge when we get there.
We will. Much like Brooks and Dunn, Nick, we'll burn that bridge when we get there.
We will indeed.
How you like that, huh?
I like it.
Hello, Miss Heartbroke. That's my Ronnie Dunn voice. I don't know if you've heard that. I'm sure you've heard that before.
I picked up on it. It's very similar to your
hello.
It's very similar to your Chip Carey.
Oh, I was going to say to my Corky from Life Goes On voice, but I don't have one. Sit your sweet self down. Yeah, it could be Skip Carey. You're right. It could be Skip Carey.
I know. That's why I said it.
I almost said Skip Bayless. It could be Skip Bayless at all.
Please don't.
No, I'm not going to do that. I wouldn't subject you to that. In any event, I guess that about wraps things up, folks. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please tune in a week from now.
Wait just a minute, Greg. You're all over the place. Does that wrap it up? Are we done?
Oh, duh. I can't believe I forgot to even look at the clock on the wall. Mm-hmm. Clock on the wall says 3 o'clock. Last call for alcohol. And also, it means that we have a minute on the clock to give you all the wrestling minute. Boy, what an eventful few days, Nick, in the world of wrestling. We had the Royal Rumble. We had NXT TakeOver. We had Raw. We had SmackDown. We had departures from WWE.
Well, not
we had
yet.
All kinds of things going on.
Yes, but primarily the shaping up of the road to WrestleMania has begun. The Royal Rumble winners, Becky Lynch, preparing to face Ronda Rousey in what will reportedly eventually become a triple threat that will incorporate Charlotte Flair as well. And then on the men's side, you got Seth Rollins taking on Brock Lesnar. All exciting stuff, especially that women's match should be the first women's main event in WrestleMania history.
Absolutely. And their interaction on Monday Night Raw got me even more stoked for that matchup than I was before.
And made you somebody who was... You said you wouldn't mind if it was a triple threat. I think it kind of swayed you in the other way of wanting it to be a one-on-one.
Mm-hmm. And yet you, now...
I'm of two minds about it. Yes, I'm conflicted.
You'd be okay with a triple threat.
On a certain level, yes, I suppose. But not from a kayfabe perspective, I suppose.
And I guess while we're extending the minute anyway... overall impressions of TakeOver and the Rumble. I liked TakeOver. I didn't think it was a great TakeOver, but it was a good TakeOver.
Every TakeOver is good. This is probably a bottom third TakeOver.
Yes. Although Ricochet and Gargano is a top tier TakeOver match.
Yes, but every TakeOver has one, at least one great match, you know?
Blow away match. And this was outstanding. Which, Nick, we knew it would happen because we saw them wrestle in the main event of Dragon Gate the weekend of WrestleMania 30, and they had a phenomenal 30-minute balls-to-the-wall match. So we knew they had this in them. Same dynamic, oddly, too, with Ricochet as the face and Gargano as the heel.
Yes.
And they delivered here again on TakeOver. Rumble, I thought, was really good, even though the two Rumble matches were the worst parts of the show, arguably.
Yes, I would agree.
So that has been... the Wrestling Minute.
Absolutely. And you know, Greg, it being Royal Rumble season, the Place to Be Nation live chats have been on fire recently with wrestling discussion, other discussion. And you know, this week we even had a little time today, I think, for some musical discussion. I know you in particular were talking about your love of Phil Collins, one of your favorite artists. And so
you know that song by Phil Collins, In the Air and the Night?
Well, that's one of them. But I was able to reach out to our good friend, WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross.
No way.
And talk to him about your love of Phil Collins. And so here he is today, and he's going to give us his own personal interpretation of one of Phil Collins' greatest hits.
All right, I will step aside. Mr. Ross, welcome aboard, sir. Welcome aboard. Pick that microphone up and you just give that song everything you got, sir.
Thanks a lot, asshole. Like I needed any help. I was doing perfectly fine before you even said that. Now, don't give me a complex about myself. How you doing over there, Nick?
I'm fine, sir. How are you?
Fair. Decent.
Do you have any travel planned in the coming months?
Well, listen. There's a lot of rumor out there. I'm not here to... I figured you'd try to do that. You are a Richard. Let's face it. Just like the rest of the people on the internet. You're a Richard. You're going to try to get me to say something about, oh, JR's going to AEW. JR's going to AEW. I don't have right now any plans for the weekend of WrestleMania. I got no plans at all. My schedule's cleared. You know, I got no plans for the month of April, to say the least. No plans to Vegas. I will say.
I didn't say anything about Las Vegas. You said Las Vegas.
There you go, putting words in my mouth.
You said Las Vegas.
You are inferring things that are not there. I could have said New York City. I could have said Chicago. I could have said Double or Nothing. I could have said anything.
Double or Nothing.
I could have said that if I wanted to, but I didn't. You're putting words in good old JR's mouth, and I don't appreciate it. I will say that I support the wrestling industry. I support individuals like Dean Ambrose and Hideo Itami that might be leaving certain businesses to explore other opportunities. And I'm saying that if you were going to explore an opportunity in this business right now, you'd have to be some kind of a damn fool not to take the money of the wonderful, the handsome and the gorgeous Shad Khan and his son, the genius Tony Khan. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to do that. I'm just saying that you'd be a fool and a loser and a moron not to do that. Well, that's just what I have to say. But anyway, I just need to get a song for me here. Okay? And I'm going to sit here and I'm going to sing this song against my will because I want people to understand that I am a team player. There's this girl that's been on my mind all the time. Sue Studio. Ho ho! Now she don't even know my name, but I think she likes me just the same. Sue Studio. Oh yeah! If she called me, I'd be there. I'd come running anywhere. She's all I need all my life. I feel so good if I just say the words Boomer Sooner. Boomer Sooner. Just say the words, oh, Boomer Sooner. Now I know that I'm too young. My love has just begun. CC Studio. Oh, yeah. Oh, give me a chance. Give me a sign, for God's sake. I'll show her anytime. Susu Studio. Oh. Now, I've just got to have her, quite frankly. Have her now. I have got to get closer, but I don't know how. She makes me nervous. A little bit like Sid when he's live. And makes me scared. But I feel so good if I just say the words, Boomer Sooner. Just say the words, Boomer Sooner. Well, now, quite frankly, that's all I need in my life. I feel so good. Look at Baker Mayfield, legendary Billy Sims. I've got Hall of Famers in my corner. I've got people, you know, legendary coaches like. I can't even think of any of their names right now, quite frankly. I got all these great people in my corner, and that's all I need in my life, quite frankly. I feel so good that if I say the words Danny Hodge, if I say the words, oh, Steve Austin, if I say the words, oh, Dr. Death, if I say the words, Jack Briscoe, just say the words now. You understand that? I don't have to meet them. I just have to say the words, Jerry Briscoe, ho, 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 The Rock, ho, 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 D'Lo Brown, Ho, 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 ho. Mark Henry. Ho, 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 ho. John Cena. Ho, 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 ho. The best pure athlete of that class. Shelton Benjamin. Ho, 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 ho. Brock Lesnar. Ho, 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 ho. Just say the damn words. Just say, just say the word. Boomer Sooner.
Hard traveling fanboys.